Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. Section 9 of William James' essay, The Will to Believe, is entitled, Faith May Bring Forth Its Own Verification. And in this section, James is providing us with several different analyses of examples drawn from different areas of life that are aimed at illustrating this very principle. And he ends his discussion there with this great sentence, there are cases where a fact cannot come at all unless a preliminary faith exists in its coming. That means that unless we already have some sort of belief commitment to something being true or something being the case, we're not going to do what is necessary or even just sufficient, perhaps, to bring about conditions in which that could be verified. And now, this is not going to apply to options and hypotheses that are not living in James' parlance or not momentous or not forced, but it will apply to things that matter quite a bit to us. And he talks about moral issues, personal matters, social issues, and then a little bit later on, religious matters. We're not going to talk so much about those examples because we're going to discuss that elsewhere separately. But he tells us that where a faith in a fact can help create that fact, it would be an insane logic which would say that faith running ahead of scientific evidence is, and he puts this in quotes, the lowest kind of immorality into which a thinking being can fall. And he says, yet this is the logic by which our scientific absolutists pretend to regulate our lives. So this is incredibly relevant in our own time when there are so many people crowing about things being evidence-based. Oftentimes you have to be kind of careful about their claims to that. When you look at their evidence, it's actually rather shaky. The studies are often inflated from very clear findings about small groups within very tightly controlled circumstances to humankind in general, right? But let's say that was actually the case. There are a lot of people who say that, well, unless you've got evidence or facts on your side, facts not feelings, logic, science, reason, then you should keep your mouth shut. And James would say, well, sometimes they're right, but a lot of times they're actually wrong. And the things that matter to us the most, they tend to be wrong. There are a lot of cases where by making some sort of commitment, we place ourselves in a situation where we can actually observe the truth, in part because it might be that we just have to get ourselves there, but it might also be that that action itself is part of what's required in order to create the situation in which these things can precipitate out. One of the examples that I'd like to use to illustrate this, which is not provided by James but derives from my own experience, is as a berry picker when I was young and also as a younger adult, I would often go out and pick black raspberries in windrows and forests and things like that. And as I was doing that, one of the things that I came to realize is when you're looking through the foliage, and I'm a pretty good woodsman because I grew up in the countryside, so I can, you know, I can look through wooded areas and I can recognize what sort of plants we're dealing with, provided I'm in an area that I know quite well, like the Midwest, or as it turned out, Germany, which has quite similar foliage in many cases. So you see the blackberries and you're like, aha, there's a blackberry bush over there. I'm going to go and start picking. But it's only when you start moving things around where you're like, whoa, there's even more there. I better get those. And you start putting all those into your bucket, and pretty soon you've got a couple gallons. And you only have those couple gallons because you didn't just go by what you can see when you're looking at the windrow from a distance. You got up there close, you moved things around, you took the risk of getting yourself cut up by the brambles. You sometimes found that there really wasn't anything there. Sometimes you saw the, you know, what looked like is going to be a very rich place, and the birds have already picked it over. Other times you hit the mother lode, but it's only because you actually did something and turned those leaves over and got your hands in there that you were able to get the reward. So we can draw this in a sort of diagram here, where we begin with what James is calling faith, a belief that X is the case. Could even be a hope, or could be a desire that X is the case. Could also be framed negatively. I'm afraid that X is the case, and so I'm going to act in such a way as to try to ward it off or to deal with it or to uncover it as a danger. Then that leads to some sort of action. There's a willing to do A, some sort of action, willing to make a commitment, willing to take a chance. Something that happens in the world. And then there's some sort of results produced by the action. And then you can observe that X is actually the case. And the action could be as simple as walking over here and opening up the book and seeing what's actually in the book. As a matter of fact, another prime example of this, particularly apt in our own time, so many people will ask me questions about something that I've discussed in media that they're watching about some philosopher and their doctrine, and I'll say, answer over and over again, you really need to read the book, right? Because they'll have some sort of objection to an idea presented essentially out of context and in isolation from the other ideas. And I'm saying, go to the native habitat of the philosopher's thought, see what's actually there. Sometimes cracking open a book or putting it on your phone or Kindle and reading through it and seeing what's there, that can be an action. But the person who says, well, I'm not going to do that until everything has been satisfactorily explained to me, well, they're never going to know anything then, are they? And that's their own choice, James would say. Now, he does give some really great examples. He begins by talking about moral questions, and he says, moral questions present themselves as questions whose solution cannot wait for sensible proof. A moral question is not of what sensibly exists, but of what is good or would be good if it did exist. Science can tell us what exists, but to compare the worths both of what exists and what does not exist, we must consult not science, but what Pascal calls the heart. Science herself consults her heart when she lays it down that infinite ascertainment of fact and correction of false belief are the supreme goods for man. Challenge the statement, science can only repeat it oracularly, or else prove it by showing that ascertainment and correction bring man all sorts of other goods, which man's heart in turn declares. So he's talking about our passional or volitional nature, as he's called it earlier. Now, what about the question of having moral beliefs at all or not having them? James says this is decided by our will. At some level, we actually have to make a decision. And this is where we get to all sorts of interesting quandaries where people are like, well, you virtue ethicists, why do you say that virtue is good? And then you provide them with the arguments and they're like, yeah, I get those, but I still don't see why I should accept this. And you're like, well, buddy, you know, that's as far as we're going to get with this conversation. You're being sort of deliberately perverse. It's up to you whether you think that these work or not. At some level, as a friend of mine used to say, you pays your money and you takes your chances. And I think he may have gotten that from James because he was a pragmatist. So are our moral preferences true or false? Or are they only odd biological phenomena, making things good or bad for us, but in themselves indifferent? He says, your intellect cannot decide this. You have to decide this for yourself. You have to actually act as if that was the case and then see what happens, or act as if it's not the case. One great way to test a moral philosophy, put it into practice. See what results from it. If you recoil from it in horror, well, you know you made a big mistake. If things start turning out good for you because you actually, you know, applied the system and stuck with it, well, there's its confirmation, right? That's as good as it's going to get for those sorts of things. He says, turning now from these wide questions of good to a certain kind of questions of fact, questions concerning personal relations, that is, states of mind between one person and another, he says, let's think about liking and love. Do you like me or not? Whether you do or not depends in countless instances on whether I meet you halfway. If I just walk up to you on the street and I'm like, hey man, you like me? You'd be like, I don't even know who the hell you are. Get out of my face, right? But if I've established a relationship with you, and after our third time meeting up with each other at the coffee shop or in the, you know, Milwaukee Stoic Fellowship or taking the elevator in our building, I say, hey, do you like me? You might say, well, I still don't know you that well, but yeah, I guess I kind of like you. You know, you seem like a decent sort of person, right? There has to be some sort of involvement, some sort of commitment before that question can be answered, yes, and that requires action on our part, meeting people halfway, as he says. He says, the previous faith on my part in your liking's existence is in such cases what makes your liking come. If I stand aloof and refuse to budge an inch until I have objective evidence, until you have done something apt, as the absolutists say, ad extorquendum ad sensum meum, right? 10 to 1, your liking never comes. This whole Latin phrase means extorting or deriving your assent, right? And then he goes on to talk about love, and he says, how many women's hearts are vanquished by the mere sanguine insistence of some man that they must love him. He will not consent to the hypothesis that they cannot, right? And this can go for either gender or across gender lines or any sort of arrangement that you want. When it comes to romantic involvement, there is something about saying to the other person, I want to be in a relationship with you. Perhaps you could fall in love with me. That tends to lead to that falling in love. Some people actually are attracted to those who they know are attracted to them. Again, there's some sort of commitment going on there. He also talks about the work world. And he says that, who gains promotions, boons, appointments, but the man in whose life they are seen to play the part, notice that he's using a technical term here, of live hypotheses, who discounts them, sacrifices other things for their sake before they have come, and take risks for them in advance. If you don't start writing the book, you're not going to find out whether you can write a great American novel. If you don't apply for the job and show up to the interview, then you can't get the job. Nobody's going to like search the database and say, oh, this is exactly the right person. I mean, unless you're lucky enough to have a headhunter working for you or an agent. In which case, they're doing that legwork, right? They're doing the action. You've just displaced it or outsourced it to another. He also talks about social matters. He says that the reason why social organisms work is because each member proceeds to their duty with a trust that the other members will simultaneously do theirs. Whenever a desired result is achieved by the cooperation of many independent persons, its existence as a fact is a pure consequence of what James calls the precursive faith in one another of those immediately concerned. So when we're in social organisms, organizations, institutions, even within social situations in which we have expectations, we do our thing, we have faith that it's going to work, and the other person rewards that, and the hypothesis is thereby confirmed or verified. When I go into Starbucks and I want to get a coffee, and it's not my preferred place to get coffee, there's better ones, but you know, I have a Starbucks card, I go up there and I order my triple venti latte, which is what I almost always get. Every once in a while, I'll have a person behind the counter who looks at me a little bit weird because they didn't get enough training or something like that. And then I say, well, it's a regular venti latte with an extra shot of espresso. And they ask me my name and take my card and carry out the transaction. The cup goes on to the next person, the barista, who is going to, you know, create the thing. And I trust they'll put in the extra shot that I paid for. And then, you know, they call my name and I go and get the coffee. There's a whole operation of things there that I have faith in And then I act on that, and then it happens. If I go into Starbucks and I say, I'm not sure if you're going to make me that coffee, I'll pay you after you make that coffee and I hear you call my name, they'll look at me like I'm an idiot. And if they're really, really bored, maybe they'll say, okay, buddy, weirdo, we'll go along with that. But for the most part, they'll say, okay, sir, step aside. We've got people in line, right? And so he has this famous example, really great example. A whole train of passengers, individually brave enough, will be looted by a few highwaymen simply because the latter can count on one another, while each passenger fears that if he makes a movement of resistance, he will be shot before anyone else backs him up. If we believed the whole car would rise at once with us, we would each severally rise and train robbing would never be attempted. And James says that this holds for pretty much all of our social institutions. There are things that we have faith in, we act on that, that faith gets confirmed precisely because we acted upon it. If we were to apply this rigorous Cliffordian standard of I'm not going to commit myself unless I have absolute objective evidence that provides complete certitude, we would never get that confirmation or verification of what it is that we're having faith in. So there are many circumstances, according to James, of our lives that involve this very dynamic where the fact cannot come at all, as he says, unless a preliminary faith exists in that fact's coming, and we act upon the basis of that faith, thereby producing the fact or the situation in which the fact can be verified. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.